Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday, the 5th of August. Very nice to have you with us on this Tuesday morning. I was running late. My thanks to Sarah for covering the billboard at the top of the show. Malia wrote to us and said that she was going to be late, and then she beat me. So, but welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here on time.
Glad you had I known that, I would have had you do the intro. But I'm glad you're here. We have a lot to talk about. We have a great group to do it with. I am very excited to have them all here, and let's get started. My first thing I want to tell you is that if you'd like to be a part of the conversation, all you got to do is go to our website and write panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you. Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, joins us. Good morning, Malia. How are you?
Good morning. Had a nice drive up on the thruway.
Longer than expected.
Longer than expected, yes.
That was fine.
Here I am.
I saw your note at 7:50 saying you're running 10 minutes late, and all of a sudden I said, uh-oh, did the roundtable start at 8?
It's when I leave the house.
Yeah, well, and sometimes you know. Yeah, you just know. Oakwood Cemetery, the Oakwood Avenue in Troy, is being paved today.
Oh, that's right.
Surprise! Did you see a sign? I never saw a sign.
No, it's just we got a, at RPI, we got an RPI message that said,
"Well, aren't you
here's
special?
Some road things to know about rural campers." Well, I guess they thought it might be useful if our students actually knew how to get to class.
That would be great. Yes, I would have found it useful of how I could have gotten here on time. But thank goodness 90% of my family is buried in Oakwood, so I could just sort of look and try to find them from the sides of the road. I visit them all the time, Jay. Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences of RPI, Jim Henwer, good morning.
Morning, Joe.
How are you?
Doing okay.
Semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer of the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm well, and I am excited about all the topics we have. The only one I'm a little disappointed we don't have on the list is the Danish Zoo asking you to send them your late in life pets so they can be fed to the predators.
Fed to the predators. I have to tell you the picture of the stalking lions going back and forth. I was tempted to do that story, but I just,
it's okay.
You're an editor. You know what kind of letters that would get.
Oh, God.
I'm so glad I didn't know about that before. Right?
It's horrible. No, it's a chilling story, and I think we all recommend that you you read it. But, you know. All right. Let's get started and start off with the many, many stories of the day. And, again, we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. We go to the state of Texas.
Always fun.
We talked about this yesterday. That was before the arrest warrants. But Texas is the Democrats are fleeing Texas or have fled Texas for the most part. And they want to try to put a halt to this redistricting bill and legislation and not want to vote. Now, this is certainly not the first time that the Texas legislator has got up and left. They've done this before. It's a mechanism. It's something that they have at their beck and call if they feel that it is warranted, and in this case they feel that it is warranted. The Texas State House reconvened Monday without dozens of Democrats who left the state to try to stop the GOP from moving ahead with enacting a new congressional map that would give them 5 more safe seats. So, Democrats said that they were undeterred by the move and officials will have difficulty arresting them because most are in suburban Chicago and beyond the jurisdiction of Texas authorities. Yes, Texas Republicans sought to retaliate against the Democrats who fled the state, voting to issue civil arrest warrants for dozens of lawmakers who left in an attempt to stymie a GOP effort to redraw the congressional maps. It makes New York almost sound like it's got its act together, doesn't it?
Almost.
Yeah. We do have to go back the last few years, how Democrats passed this law that was, we called it a sham of an independent redistricting commission. But for all its faults, the courts have read this in its best version and said, you cannot do the thing. You can't gerrymander under this. So kicking and screaming. And even against their machinations, the Democrats have been forced into, you know, better government when it comes to redistricting in New York. So to retreat is the big question. You know, what do you do with this when this isn't like bringing a knife to a gunfight? It's like, I was trying to come up with a metaphor, and it was like bringing crayons and magic markers to a nuclear war. you're trying to be good. You're trying to be pure, whether you like it or not. But you're doing the right thing for the voters. And all of a sudden, another state comes along and says, "Yeah, we're going to rig the game."
You know, I don't think anything says action quite like, we're leaving.
Yeah.
We're going that's away.
That's a stand.
Yeah,
or the opposite of it. But it's moving. I think power to them.
So meanwhile, the other part of the story, which we can take separately, but I just want to include it. We are at war, says New York State Governor Kathy Hochul at a news conference with some of the Texas Democrats, where she affirmed that she supported changing or disbanding the independent commission that draws congressional lines. And that's why the gloves are off, and I say, bring it on. So in other words, if you gain 5 in Texas, a red state, and then perhaps you gain seats in New York, a largely blue state, then you see you fight fire with fire, as it were. So there are several aspects of the story, the fact that the legislature left, the fact that these warrants have been issued, and the lack of jurisdiction, I think, is interesting, too. And then, of course, that New York, among them, but other states as well, thinking about bringing on their own action to prevent or to allow, rather, redistricting in their states, especially before the 2000. And next year is 2006 midterm elections.
So, Joe, I have a question. Maybe one of our listeners will know, which is, what authority are they using to issue? What law are they using to issue these summonses? Right. None of the stories that I've read, it keeps saying they've issued these civil issues, they're putting in these fines, things like that. So there must be something they've done somewhere along the line that allowed that. But I don't see.
It's probably the same authority by which they're seeking to arrest the acting county clerk of Ulster County, one of my neighbors, who they don't like what he's doing to support a local private doctor and how she's treating her patients, some of whom are in Texas. And does that have any holding power in New York? It doesn't seem like it.
But in one case, there's an explicit law that Texas passed that, yeah, again, is being foot up. But this one, before I can get arrested on a civil warrant, there's got to be a law that was broken
it's an indictment and all that fun stuff. It's a Ken Paxton law. Ken Paxton invented this law. He issued an opinion and basically said the courts cannot the courts can't find that there's a problem with this if they issue the warrants. I believe that's the case, and they have to accept the warrant. Now, attorneys general have a lot of power, but they don't have the power to tell the courts what they can and cannot accept. So this is simply an opinion that Ken Paxton came up with. I mean, you know, the idea that a legislature can force members to attend, you know, the sergeant at arms goes out and supposedly enforces this, is, I think, a longstanding fact. But whether you can criminally charge someone, that's another issue.
What would the and I guess I don't really understand the criminal nature here. And again, this is not the first time that this has been done by the Texas legislature, and I don't remember in those past flights by the Texas legislature that there were motions made to arrest them.
They tried different things before. So in 2021, the Democrats left, but I think the more salient example is in 2003. They went on the lam, and at that time, a bunch of Democratic legislators, yeah, it's the Wild West. They went to Oklahoma, and the Texas authorities at that time sent the Texas Rangers after them. Now,
horseback and everything.
I know it's like out of a bad movie. But the Texas Rangers, I don't understand their authority to operate in other states, and it's unclear from the reporting I've seen. I mean, the Democrats came back from Oklahoma before the Rangers got anywhere close to them. But it what I've seen implies that the Rangers did cross in Oklahoma. So Texas is obviously willing to take all kinds of quasi-legal action in support of this undemocratic and irresponsible move, which is not about serving the voters. It's about serving the Republican Party at the state and the national level. And I would say, you know, any other state that wants to follow that example is similarly irresponsible and undemocratic. I mean, there are ways to fight gerrymandering, and if there are a way for New York to take action now to negate the gains immediately that the Texas Republicans are seeking, that think they'll get in this, then you know that I could sort of understand the justification. I might not support it, but I would understand it. But what Governor Hochul's talking about isn't even possible until after the next. So it wouldn't have an immediate effect. So I don't understand why she's, other than she's trying to, in her mind, appear to have some kind of leadership. But
I'm sorry, Jim, but really quick, isn't it? My understanding, too, though, that there is some question as to whether it would even with, let's say everybody was there and nobody took off in Texas, that there was question as to even there whether it would be passed in time to impact the 2006 midterm elections.
Well, and in Texas or New
York? Yeah, in Texas.
In Texas. I think they could do it in time.
Well, I think that's what the Democrats are hoping to do with the story.
Just push it out.
Every other time they've done this, right, one way or the other, they have to come back sooner or later. I mean, they have lives. You get, one of the story points out that the addition to your income for being a member of the Texas state legislature is $7,200, and they're being charged $500 a day fines. Now, again, those fines will be fought in court, et cetera, et cetera. What you're looking at, though, I think is a story, you know, partly political theater, obviously, on their part, on Hochul's part. Newsom is actually one of the few people who seems to actually have the ability to potentially do something. You know, the whole thing's crazy because it all comes down to the fact that a number of states, yesterday on the show, everyone was saying, oh, gerrymandering, everybody does it, da, 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 which is mostly true with one exception. Almost all the states only do it every 10 years when the census comes out. Texas, somewhere along the line, and apparently several of the other red states did the same thing, made it so that didn't have that in their constitution and therefore simply passed rules that said we can redistrict anytime we want, right? And so I think that's where Hochul is trying to make, you know, again, it may be theater, but it's she's trying to make the point that here we're trying to be responsible, stick to the 10-year, do that, and these people are doing it. And it's, as you say, it's bringing the crayons to the nuclear war.
I'm sorry.
That was his.
Bring it on. I believe yeah. was the.
That's right. Well, and I think she will, you know, try to threaten legislation try to get some stuff into the courts, things like that, perhaps. Depends what happens in Texas. She did say that New York would only try to push this through if Texas pursued it. California said the same thing, and so did several other blue states, that they will keep their current districts unless the Texas redistricting happens, in which case they will see it that they are being forced to do it. The other thing I would point out is a lot of these cases went before the Supreme Court during the previous 6 to 8 years. And the Supreme Court has had the opportunity to make gerrymandering harder and or illegal, and instead went just the other way. The Trump court said, hey, the states want to do this, they can do this. And, you know, if they want to change their own constitutions, do it. That's not a federal issue.
The other thing, too, here, and I know I apologize for being Pollyannish in this particular observation. However, just because you've changed the seat doesn't necessarily mean you're going to pick up the seat. I mean, I understand the whole point of redistricting is to get it so that the odds are with you in doing that. But you aren't completely circumventing the actual vote. Which I would point out,
and that could backfire on them. I mean, there is some. I think there's some hope out there that the public reaction to this will be that. I don't hold out that hope.
It's hard.
So
we have about 30 seconds.
Computationally, the answer is, and somebody said this yesterday. I mean, it's literally down to a science now, where you can get it almost to the individual. Person. And I mean, you know, there's literally places right now in New York State where if you live on this side of the street, you're in one district. And if you live on that side of the street, you're in another. And we're not nearly as bad as some other places. So,
all right. We will continue this conversation when we come back. We have a lot of letters and we welcome yours. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. And we would love to hear from you as we continue our conversation this morning. And we will do just that after this news update from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday morning. We are looking at the issue of Texas and the Democrats in Texas. I'm going to use Malia's term, on the lam. And they're out and about throughout the country. They are not in Texas. And those Republicans in Texas are upset by that, so much so that they're getting ready to issue arrest warrants for those who are not where they believe they should be. Now, the other thing, which I thought was interesting about this, and this gets into our point about, you know, these districts themselves, and there's an article in the New York Times today about GOP bets big on Hispanic voters with the new Texas map. In order to flip 5 U.S. House seats, Republicans are gambling that they can retain President Trump's 2024 gains with Latinos and that voters won't mind their hardball tactics. And that's the question. We don't know that, do we?
Well, if the Democrats were smart in Texas, they would be showing all sorts of ICE footage. There's plenty of it out there. And highlighting all the mistakes that have been made in this mass roundup of Hispanic, Latino people. And just letting them know this is a racial policy, a racist policy, and hammering that point home, and it could backfire on them. I mean, and it could also, as we said earlier, as we talked about earlier, it could backfire on them just with potentially with voters saying, "You're not going to take away you're not going to effectively disenfranchise me for the sake of one party's power."
I don't think Democrats can. I have no doubt they'll probably take the strategy you just outlined, Jay. But I don't think they can count on highlighting the racist enforcement of these policies by ICE as bringing a lot of Hispanics away from. There's a growing support among Latino and Hispanics around the country for Republicans, and that it's confusing to a lot of people. But I think one of the Democrats' big strategic mistakes over the past several elections is to think of Latinos and Hispanics as a voting bloc, mm-hmm. and it's an incredibly diverse group of people from across the entire hemisphere. And some of them have been here for generations. Some of them have newly arrived. They come through all kinds of different programs. And I know a lot of Hispanics who came through the legal channels that were available to them and are resentful mm-hmm. of those who didn't. And that's partly why some of the Latino support for Republican policies has been rising. So I don't think Democrats should avoid pointing out the racist policies, but I don't think that'll be enough to overcome this sort of Hispanic move in some quarters towards Republicanism.
So I do think the
Go ahead.
The fierceness, shall we say, of what's been going on, some of the raids and things, that has not been playing well for them. And in fact, the last polls I saw, which of course polls are polls, but showed significant Latino, not so much, it wasn't Democrat Republican, it was towards the current immigration policies. Mm-hmm. And they had, it was a very significant swing, partly because of the, again, postulating on the part of the pollsters, they were saying, the anecdotal information you get along with the numbers. A lot of people were saying, people who were here legally are now having that legal that legal right removed, and then they're being deported, which suddenly puts them into a very different situation, because I'm here legally because I came in under such and such a program, and now I know that Trump tomorrow could cancel that program and I'd be back to having to start all over again. So I think that's it. I think a lot of the people who, the Dreamers are getting old enough now to vote, and I think that's going to be an interesting group to see what happens. I think there's going to be a lot of fear on the part of Latinos to going to the polls, even though they're here legally, because I'd be stunned if ICE doesn't have a major forces gather around some of the key polling areas again, just to stage the get it on the video.
In case anyone thinks it's only Democrats who flee Texas, there is an instance of Republican lawmakers fleeing a state because they wanted to avoid a vote. And this was 2019 in Oregon. 11 Republicans went into hiding or fled because they didn't want to vote on some climate legislation. And so that prevented the Oregon State Senate from having a quorum, and they couldn't vote on the legislation at the time.
Were they arrested eventually, or charged, or fined? Or
they eventually came back. Yes, the Oregon governor at the time sent the Oregon State Police to bring the absent Republican senators back to the Capitol and imposed the daily $500 fine. They were defiant, and right-wing militia groups stood up in support of these Republican lawmakers. So it didn't come to actual violence, but I think of things like that I don't think that Governor Hochul's wrong when she says this is a war. It is a war, we don't want it to turn into a violent kinetic war, right? And so that's why I don't feel comfortable, to put it mildly, with statements like "bring it on." There are ways to combat gerrymandering and other political shenanigans that don't that are more responsible than engaging in the same kind of behavior that you're excoriating. It just doesn't make sense to
me. If the courts are basically saying this is all okay, what other strategies are there?
Yeah.
Well, the problem is none of the,
No,
sorry.
You're good.
The problem is none of them are fast acting, right? So there are some states where they have independent commissions that determine that, and that to me seems like a responsible and thoughtful way to do it, to try to get politics out of the district lines. You could also try ranked choice voting. I mean, it was very interesting to watch how that worked in New York City. I don't know how that would be implemented in different states, but that is an option that is available that is different from gerrymandering, right? That preserves people's freedom to vote and doesn't negate the value of their vote by putting them into some kind of weird district.
So, of course, New York City with Mamdani is going to become the poster child against that, because they'll pull out the Muslim card and all the other fear factors and the socialism and the communism and all that other stuff.
Right.
And the anti-Semitism, all the things that have been thrown at Mamdani.
Yeah.
And they'll say, if it wasn't for ranked choice voting, we would have Andrew Cuomo.
Right. So I list that as a tactic, right? I'm not in favor of the outcome that it produced in New York City, but it is something that is available. And
I think you're very reasonable at a time where the problem is that just isn't working. And just for example.
I know that we're in an emergency
almost
situation.
All those states which have redistricting commissions tie it to the 10-year census, right, as they should, right? As New York did originally, as a lot of other places did. The problem is the states that didn't do that are heavily Southern, heavily Republican, or at least red states, as we would now call them. A lot of these districts, you know, you look at the map of the districts across the U.S. when you look at the voting map, it looks all red, right? When you do it by the number of people, you suddenly see that it's a much more balanced thing. This is for state voting. This is for others. But the problem is the state assemblies and senates and then into the congressional districts, those are at that much lower state. So I can take a very rural district and give them the same. I don't have to give them the same number of voters as I give to, the city of Dallas. So I can break Dallas into three pieces and I can make some rural Lubbock, you know, an entire district. Okay. And in one case, you've got, I used to know these actual population numbers. But in one case, you've got thousands of people voting in one district. In the other case, you've got way, way less. So, you know, you've got 2,000 in one and 10,000 the other. So you're diluting votes as part of gerrymandering. You know, it really takes away from the American idea of one person, one vote.
I have learned something over the last 15 minutes, which is that our email server is working.
Are we inundated?
We got a lot.
Oh, good.
We got a lot.
Good.
So let's take a break. When we come back, we'll work our way through them and hear what's on your mind when it comes to this. And we welcome your letters, too. Don't think that you're out in the cold just because you're not in yet. You can certainly join us. panel@wamc.org. We will continue our conversation right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. As I mentioned, lots of letters this morning. We welcome yours. panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc. We are talking about the Texas legislature, the Democrats in the Texas legislature leaving the state, fleeing the state to put off a vote on redistricting within the state of Texas and the other states, including New York, who are eyeing this as an option as a way to get with the war, as stated by the governor. Okay, let's go to Janet. Why can't AI be used to draw up fair boundaries? Jim Henor, answer that question.
It absolutely could, and the answer is it would be fair boundaries. So there's not a single politician in America
who wants
who'd
fair.
Like to see it happen.
Nobody wants fair. But it's nice.
For what it's worth, is Fran Berman, who's also a commentator, and I, we had a student years ago do this using just math, not even AI, just do fair districting in New York based totally on population, completely ignoring political information and making every district rectilinear. So it was either a rectangle or a square. And you ended up with only a slightly Democratic. It was not all that different than the districts that had been gerrymandered, but it was a completely fair thing. But, you know, again, who would use that? Well, the answer is neither side is at the moment showing a lot of inclination to be fair. So, you know, if we wanted fair districting, there's a lot of ways to achieve it. AI would maybe help, but frankly, it's really machine learning and data analytics that get you there.
Back to the letters. We go to Gloria. Republicans recently left D.C. to stop a vote. Johnson dismissed the House to avoid the vote on the Epstein file. This was wrong.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good point. That's a very good point. True. Then,
gee, hypocrisy in government?
When the party in power does it, it's not illegal.
That was different.
Yeah.
Lillian says, is a liberal democracy of government even possible when everybody thinks this is a game? Government is serious business. There are repercussions that occur when rules change and people are arrested and denied rights. That's a great letter because it does seem like a game.
And this is very, I mean, you know, if any one person has helped us, the parties certainly have both contributed to this situation. But if there is one person who has exacerbated this, it's Donald Trump, who treats everything like it is a zero-sum game in which either he wins or everybody has to lose.
And, you know, I think, Joe, there's been a lot of recent literature looking at this, experiments going back 10, 15 years, but much more now, showing that party affiliation has become something that for many people has replaced other kinds of affiliations, you know, your church, your religion, your community, partly because of the spread of people. You know, there's 50 different things saying it, but I was starting to say during the break that there's a famous experiment where a law that had passed some years ago with a completely bipartisan vote, right, was shown to groups of voters who identified as Democratic and Republican. In one case, it was introduced as the Democrats put this forward. In the other case, the Republicans put this forward. And guess what happened? The actual text of the thing that had been, you know, in a bipartisan way embraced, suddenly, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but super statistically, the Republicans, you know, were in favor of the Republican one and against the Democratic one, and vice versa. So, you know, Mark Whitman was saying yesterday that if only the Democratic Party would come up with better strategies and better, you know, programs and politics. I was sitting there trying to say, you know, I'd love to call in or write in, but I'll be there tomorrow, so I don't have to. But that's just not happening anymore, partly because of this identification. The other thing is, look at what happened during the Biden term. You had, you know, the Recovery Act. You had infrastructure that had been ignored forever. You know, you had a very popular thing going on, but then when it came to the election, as you say, it became Trump versus Harris. Yeah. And, you know, that's how most Americans vote, is based on the personalities. And again, I wish I was making this up. I wish I was just giving you my opinion. But there's literature out there. There are experiments.
Been saying that for a decade. We wish we were making this up.
Yeah, well, that's true.
That's a good.
I keep hoping I'll wake up some morning and discover.
That could be the slogan for the roundtable.
Yeah, one of many. Let's see. Let's go to back to the letters, if that's okay, and we go to David, who brings up the Dreamers. Dreamers may be old enough to vote, but they can't, as they are not citizens, unfortunately. Good point. Then we go to Theo.
But they do have impact on their colleagues. You do see a fairly strong social media presence there. So, yes, I apologize. I didn't mean they could vote. I meant they are of voting age and therefore of an age to influence others.
All right, here's one from Theo. I find it confusing that the media headlines say Texas is getting 5 Republican seats, but they are restructuring to eliminate 5 currently held Democratic seats. They aren't adding 5 new seats to the total. This issue is disenfranchising seats already held by Democrats.
Yes,
that's correct.
Check, Theo.
And the way they're doing it is what's problematic. As one of the Texas legislators was explaining yesterday, she represents an urban district, and the way they gerrymandered it was basically to pull in a bunch of rural districts that have nothing in common with the voters in her district, in her current district. And that was always one of the kind of objective standards or semi-objective standards that was used to gauge whether a redistricting was legitimate or not, whether it was gerrymandering or a proper redistricting, was the commonality of interest, the compactness of the district, to pull in a bunch of, to pull in, farmers and rural residents in Texas with Austin, let's say. I'm not sure which the districts are. I haven't looked at the map. It makes no sense. Right. And the Supreme Court ought to be, this ought to be a case ripe for the Supreme Court, so, but they don't seem to.
It's already gone to the Supreme Court. So racial gerrymandering had been by the Supreme Court ruled out, right? So saying we're doing this so that this generally is black versus white, but it also included others. That was illegal. And if you could show that a gerrymander, district was made to reduce or to disenfranchise. But then political gerrymandering came along. And when that went to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court said, there had been a lower court ruling that said, okay, if it's mathematically proven that you're doing this for those reasons, then no, you're not allowed. And the Supreme Court overruled them. And now, some of these, look at Abbott. He's saying, we are doing this to guarantee that Trump can maintain. He's not making any pretense about what the purpose of this is. And that is because the Supreme Court has already ruled on it in his favor or in the favor. And, the other thing I found interesting is most of the courts in blue states went with fair redistricting. Many of the courts in the red states didn't. And again, a lot of it has to do with whether judges are voted for or appointed, whether, each state controls a lot of power of its judiciary. And I think that's another thing we see that cause, at a root cause of some of this stuff. So it's very, very complicated. Mm-hmm. And most Americans follow it as much as they follow any political stuff, i.e. not much.
Back to the letters before we go to a break. Jane says, what's the difference, panelists, between a civil arrest warrant and a regular arrest warrant?
I do not know.
I'm not 100% sure, but I think I know we have lawyers out there who will correct me, but my understanding was that a civil warrant doesn't necessarily have to go through a grand jury. Whereas a criminal warrant, an indictment, has to go through a grand jury.
I think you're right. This is not even something that needed to go through a judge.
A civil arrest warrant is a court order authorizing law enforcement to arrest someone in a non-criminal civil case, typically for failing to comply with a court order or appear in court. It's distinct from a criminal arrest warrant and often involves enforcing a judgment or compelling someone to appear in a civil proceeding.
It could be that the legislature in Texas has the power to do that.
They might. Well,
I don't know. I'm winging it here. So
they are used to enforce civil court orders, such as those related to child support, family law matters, or judgments in debt cases. So that gives you an idea where we're headed. Okay. Let's go over to John. I truly don't understand how gerrymandering is legal, but I guess it is. Has anyone ever sued for disenfranchisement after having been gerrymandered out of a particular district?
Yes. And they lost. I do not know if there has been a class action, but individuals do not have the standing to take the state to court on these kind of issues. That's and I that may vary from state to state. Again, I have no legal background, but my understanding is, at least in most states, the answer is no, you can't do that.
Robert says the left is always lecturing us about dangers to democracy. Democracy is when the people's representatives legislate. Just because Democrats are in the minority in Texas doesn't give them the moral or legal right to flee the state and prevent the legislature from taking action they don't care for. Can you imagine the reaction if Republicans were to prevent the Democratic majority in a state legislature from taking action on behalf of the people? That from Robert. Then we go to John. Nice of Governor Hochul to say she's going to push for sudden redistricting when it can't be done until 2028, and only then if the people of New York vote to allow it. If Governor Hochul really, shouted caps, wanted to strike back at Texas, she'd have our state issue arrest warrants for Ken Paxton and other Texas state politicians for some similarly flimsy reason. That, shouty cap, would be more tit for tat. But really, we need a federal constitutional amendment that not only bans gerrymandering, but creates very harsh punishments for any attempts at it.
Oh, that'd be wonderful. And who gets to decide whether we do a constitutional amendment? Oops.
I think that's got as much chance as a as getting rid of the Electoral College. Yep. You essentially have, last time I looked, and things might have changed in the last few years, but you essentially have a government of the minority in the United States, that the white minority, what is increasingly becoming a white minority. And a conservative white minority is in power because of the way the Senate is structured by the states. I mean, it's not going to be structured any other way, but because the Electoral College picks the president as opposed to the popular vote. And now the last thing that can be rigged, essentially, is the House of Representatives. And this is how you rig the House of Representatives. And I think that's why fundamentally this becomes a discussion not about Democrats or Republicans. It becomes a discussion about a two-party system, which we accept is the norm in the United States, versus a one-party system, which is what the Republicans are trying to do at this point. That is not, I am not saying that as a liberal, as a conservative, as anything but an observer of the system. And what we have is a party that is trying to do a power grab and one of a permanent nature.
Real quick, one more letter, and then we'll go over to a break. Zach says, I fear that this is the beginning of our national divorce. Let's say this happens in other states, and more legislators flee their states, and they are arrested when they return, if they return. Does the constituency follow along? Does the federal government start arresting the legislators using ICE agents? Unfortunately, I agree with our governor. We are at war. That from Zach. We welcome your thoughts. Panel at WAMC.org. We're going to move on to other topics on the other side of this news break. We welcome you to be a part of it, and we'll continue after news. Mm-hmm. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. This morning, Malia DeMontis here, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College. Jim Henler is Heatherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI. And Jay Jochnowitz is Editor-at-Large, Columnist, Editorial Writer at Times Union. Is that all the same? Am I right on that?
That's all I'm doing right now.
Okay, good. Yeah, that's enough. That's our group this morning. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. I should say, that seems like enough. You certainly can do as many things as you want to do, but I...
that seems like a lot.
I did muse to my colleagues yesterday that if I was still a... I should probably mute this, but if I was still a smart aleck reporter,
yes.
I would probably have called both the minority leaders of the Senate, the state Senate, and the Assembly yesterday, and it was a wistful moment of just wishing I could be a reporter and do that, and ask them, well, if you're critical of Kathy Hochul for threatening redistricting, how do you feel gerrymandering? How do you feel about Texas, and how do you feel about Donald Trump doing the same thing? And just to see if they would bite. Their press releases were very well nuanced on that point. And they definitely avoided any criticism of what Texas was doing, any criticism of what Donald Trump had gotten Texas to do. But anyway, I'm not a smart right. aleck reporter anymore.
No. all right. Let's go to Pete Hegseth. And this is what we'll call an office dispute. I don't know. And here we go. So this is an exclusive from the Washington Post, a very interesting article, I thought, that was posted last night and gives us a sense of, because there has been a lot of tumult and turmoil and backstabbing and all kinds of things within Hegseth's office. And so this looks to that and tells us that but there's more. So Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's acting chief of staff tried and failed to oust a senior White House liaison assigned to the Pentagon. People familiar with the matter said this Monday, detailing an unusual dispute that marks the latest instance of infighting among a staff plagued by disagreement and distrust. The clash last week between Ricky Buria, Hegseth's acting chief of staff, and Matthew McNitt, who coordinates personnel policy as White House liaison at the Pentagon, appears rooted in Buria's frustration with pushback from the White House as he has attempted to fill positions in the defense secretary's office. It coincides, too, and this seems key to me, but maybe I'm just reading this wrong, it coincides, too, with the White House's refusal to let Buria take over the powerful chief of staff job on a permanent basis. Those familiar with the situation, which has not been previously reported, spoke on the condition of anonymity to avoid reprisal from the Trump administration. The dispute between Buria and McNitt appears to have shaken a fragile agreement between Hegseth and the White House, which allowed Buria to serve as chief of staff only unofficially after several other people were considered for the position but declined to take it. The people familiar with the matter said that if officials at the White House intervened when Buria tried to get rid of McNitt, effectively blocking the move. Anna Kelly, a White House spokeswoman, said in a statement that Trump is fully supportive of Secretary Hegseth and his efforts to restore a focus on war fighters at the Pentagon rather than diversity efforts and woke initiatives.
So I'll step in. I think Malia probably knows more of the inside story sometimes than I do, but
and she's a chief of staff, so she probably knows.
But but in some ways, Joe, what's happening in the Department of Defense scares me more than anything else going on in the government, and it gets the least coverage sometimes. And You know, I often listen to Libby talking about authoritarians and what it takes and da-da-da, and feel like it's overblown. But this is the kind of story that scares me. Not so much this particular story, but what this story represents, which is the executive branch trying to truly take over the Pentagon rather than having the president has always been technically the commander-in-chief, makes the final decisions on a lot of things, but to get down into this level. So there was a story about, I think it was 6 days ago, that now to be, so always to be promoted from a three-star to a four-star general, which is a very big deal, required the president's signature. It was typically a rubber stamp once the generals, you know, the boards and the commissions that make those decisions would recommend someone. Trump has now made a rule that you will not get promoted to a four-star until you have had a personal interview with him and he decides that he's willing to sign. This truly scares me because most of the four-star generals I've met, and I've met a lot because of all these weird DOD things I used to do, really were committed to America, really were committed to democracy and the American idea. And we've seen Trump working very hard to find generals who will become his will do what he says, right? And that scares me because the key thing an authoritarian state needs, one is control of the press and the other is control of the military. And we hear a lot in the newspapers about control of the press and all that, but this control of the military has been happening quietly and backstage. You do hear occasionally Hegseth and Trump and da-da-da. But to understand that the mixed civilian and military rule in the Pentagon, leadership. So, you know, there's a chief and a secretary of each branch, and those are, you know, one is civilian, one is military. To when you start blurring those things, that's to me very scary because now you're starting to get people who will obey laws or obey requests that in the past they wouldn't. So, there were a lot of stories in Trump 1 about how a lot of the DOD had been positioning things to make sure that if Trump ordered, say, a nuclear strike or something like that, that has to go through a lot of levels. And they were trying to make sure that even though he had the right, that there would be enough scrutinizing of the decision. Once you start replacing the top of that pyramid with people who'll just say yes, then it just starts to get, you just give the president tremendously more power.
To your point about scariness, I would point listeners to an interview that I did on Thursday with Tim Weiner,
yes,
who is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist who has a new book out called The Mission, which is about the CIA in the 21st century. However, when we were talking about this, when I was asking him about, you know, where we were, he said the scariest thing is right now is who's in charge, who's there, and obviously with the Defense Department and what is happening is the scariest thing he sees as well. So that's certainly an opinion.
Well, I feel vindicated.
Shared,
now,
yes,
I'm not just
shared
making
by,
it up.
By many, I think, but it is scary.
Yeah. So I must preface my remarks by saying I'm representing my own opinion and not that of the Army Reserve or the Department of Defense. I think this is an odd story in a number of ways, and I don't know any of the personalities involved. So the chief of staff position in the secretary's office is a very powerful position. However, it's not a Senate-confirmed position. So the difference in responsibilities and authority between an acting and a permanent, I don't think there's a lot you can't do as an acting. I may be wrong in that, but Because this person, their job is obviously to manage the secretary's office. The chief of staff does not go up to Capitol Hill and meet with lawmakers on behalf of the department. The chief of staff does not go over to the old executive office building and represent the department in policy discussions. So if you're in acting, that's the kind of thing that you couldn't do in other kinds of positions than the Department of Defense. But acting chief of staff, I can't think of anything that this person, Beria, can't do as an acting. So why would that be, other than pettiness, an impetus for picking a fight with the White House? Now,
don't underestimate pettiness.
Yeah. And also just to clarify for any listeners who don't know, it's normal procedure for the White House to have a liaison in all the different major federal agencies. That's how they manage all the political appointees. That's the case in every administration. So that the presence of that person in DOD is not unusual. Now, it seems like the question is the degree to which the White House is clashing.
Is empowering that liaison.
Well, but the liaison is always empowered. I mean, so the White House always nominates political appointees to take certain positions. And so it seems like Beria doesn't agree, may not agree, or feels like the White House isn't moving quickly enough to fill some of the vacancies. I know there are still a large number of vacancies of political appointee positions or people who are acting in positions that do require them to represent the Department of Defense. And so that does limit their ability to fully fulfill their responsibilities if they're just acting. So that is the question to me. There are two questions. One is, you know, how many of these vacancies is the White House, are they maintaining them empty on purpose? You know, does Beria have people in mind the White House doesn't agree with? I mean, that's all behind the scenes. And the other is how much does Pete Hegseth know about this? I mean, this is his chief of staff who's sort of going to bat against the White House in his own office. And it says a lot about his leadership or, you know, lack thereof. It also speaks to the role that he's taken from the beginning. He came from Fox News. He's the public face of the department. He's out there, you know, on the news, whatever, giving speeches, giving talks, and he's not interested in running the department. So there probably is a degree to which the chief of staff has more to resolve and manage than has been the case in previous administrations. One person who's not really mentioned in this is the deputy secretary. And the deputy secretary, the number two in the department, Steven Weinberg, who is a Wall Street guy who had a lot of experience in defense contracting, like that is a Senate-confirmed position. And that person does do a lot of managing of the day-to-day of the department. And the reason Steven maybe it's Feinberg. I think I got his last name wrong. Was brought in was to reform not so much the personnel but the acquisition processes. But this kind of discussion of internal vacancies would typically also be something that the deputy secretary would be deeply involved in. So where is he in this? It's very strange to me that this is being reported as a disagreement between the chief of staff and a White House liaison when, like, that's not the full story.
Well, but I do think there's a piece of this Washington Post reporting that I just want to point out. So it says, the dispute between Beria and McNitt appears to have shaken a fragile agreement between Hegseth and the White House, which allowed Beria to serve as chief of staff. So it seems like my understanding was
I don't have
that
a lot of faith in whether that's actually like what agreement existed. I mean, it appears to have shaken an agreement that may have existed. I don't know.
I mean, you know, all I can say is the White House seems to be trying to apply far more control over the high end of the Pentagon than they have in the past.
Oh, that's true, yes.
You know, it reminds me, this what you were talking about, Jim, of the generals being called in for personal interviews with the president. It reminded me, we were talking before about, you know, the Comey loyalty pledge that the president insisted that the head of the FBI pledges personal loyalty to Trump, or pledges loyalty to Trump personally. And, you know, we're seeing that play out in the Justice Department now, in the FBI now, with people, you know, of unquestioned loyalty to the president, and seeing what, you know, that is creating. It's creating an authority, you know, the framework of an authoritarian government. And I think, as you pointed out, you know, control of the military is a big part of that. So that's, you know, that's kind of the first step in all this, is that I don't want to paint Hegseth as some sort of noble character, because I think he's just a journalistic hack. But I think he may actually believe what he says, and believe that this whole warfighter ethos that he is, you know,
lethality
he talked about
is his new favorite word.
Lethality. That's the other one. Yeah. Is that he really thought he was going to accomplish this. So the big question I have, and unfortunately the Post, this was a Post story, I think, it really did not get into what is the real, what's really going on? What is this fragile truce between Hegseth and the president? Is, you know, is it, you know, reality show president meets wannabe, you know, defense secretary, tough guy, lethality, Mr. Lethality, and they're having a real disagreement about what is the nature of the command, you know, what is going to be the command of the military, and what is the priority? Is it people of competence? Is it people of loyalty to the country, the Constitution, the people who care about their troops, people who want to keep us out of war?
I can't believe that Hegseth would argue against Trump on any of those.
That is...
I don't. He's not on the side of what you're
just...
But
I don't think Trump is on the side of everything I just talked about.
No, neither of them. So that's why it's odd. It's an odd story.
But yeah, I mean, doesn't it seem, though, just to take a fraction of what you just said and to respond to it, Jay, doesn't it seem that from the very beginning and with the signal controversy and so forth, that here was a guy who was against the ropes and just sort of needed one more screw up to put him over the edge, and then he had three... And it hasn't put him over the edge yet, but it seems like a president who doesn't want to admit that there was a mistake made in hiring someone who wasn't up for the job.
Right. I think he'd rather marginalize them until he gets to the point that he gets to do a dramatic, you're fired.
Right. Or
in as cruel a way as possible.
Give him a nice send-off as he goes to run for governor of Tennessee, which I've also heard.
Yeah.
Well, he's got the jawline. He does have a jawline.
He doesn't. Yeah, he's got that. As the president said, he has the look,
and he has the hair.
Yeah, he has the look. He has the hair, and hence why he was on television for so long. All right, let's go to a couple of letters on this, and then we'll take a break before we go over to other things. Let's see. The Defense Department kerfuffle. It's not surprising to me. In an authoritarian regime, minions jockey for power and influence without regard for the public good. Okay. Let's see. This one is also there's we still have many about the Texas Attorney General. And we'll welcome those as well. Let's see. The Texas AG is suing the Ulster County Clerk for not helping them go after a doctor who provided the abortion pill to one woman. This is what Malia was mentioning earlier. They called New York a bunch of baby-killing liberals. So what do they think about cutting U.S. aid, which by all estimates will kill millions of children in the next 5 to 10 years? How does any of this make sense?
That's another new tagline for the show. How does any of this make sense?
I like it.
Or hypocrisy? Really?
I'm not going to be loved for bringing this up. You know, one of the I fully support what the Ulster County Clerk is doing, and I fully support the idea that this New York doctor should not be extradited to Texas. Certainly. On the other hand, I also have been trying, and I cannot square it, except unless you go purely ideological on this. I can't square it with the idea that if a company in Texas was sending, was mailing handguns to people in New York, that New York wouldn't be able to say we're gonna extradite you and prosecute you. We want this person. We want this company brought to justice. I mean, you got a law in one state being violated by a doctor in another state. Is it really that different? And does New York is there a legal argument here as opposed to just a fundamentally philosophical one that New York is saying, look, the right to abortion is sacrosanct in our state. And we are not going to let you punish one of our doctors for providing it in your state. I can't square that legally or logically. I can only square it ideologically.
We're going to continue our conversation after a short break and finish up the last half hour of the program. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We ask that your letters be short and to the point so we can get to many as possible. We still have some big subjects to discuss on the program this morning, and we will do exactly that. Malia Dumont, Jim Henler, Jay Jochnowitz making up the group this morning. And again, we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It is Tuesday, the 5th of August, 10:33 in the morning, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Okay, Jim Henler, confuse us. Let's talk about Russia's internet. So here's the article that that prompted this in my brain from the New York Times, which says that Russia is escalating its efforts to curtail online freedom, taking new steps toward a draconian state-controlled internet. The authorities are cracking down on workarounds that Russians have been using for access to foreign apps and banned content, including through new laws passed by President Putin this past week. Moscow has also been impeding the function of services from U.S. tech companies like YouTube that Russians have used for years. At the same time, the Kremlin is building out a domestic ecosystem of easily monitored and censored Russian alternatives to Western tech products. That includes a new state-approved messaging service, Max, M-A-X, all capital letters, which where you can also watch Hacks, by the way, which will come pre-installed by law on all new smartphones sold in Russia starting next month.
So, so the internet has those things that are internationally controlled and those things where, as they cross a border, there are things you could do. Suffice to say that we could get into a lot of details here. China is really the place that proved this out. China has very, very strict rules. In fact, I'm on the board of a journal that's jointly published between the U.S. and China, and one of the problems is we have trouble having an editorial board meeting online because they're not allowed to use, you know, three or four messaging platforms, and we're not allowed to use two or three that they're allowed to use. So, you know, they are only allowed to use Zoom under certain situations and things like that. That's what we usually end up having to do is find some way around it. It is very complicated, and then China will pass a new law, in which case they have to decide if they're going to break the law or not. Or China can explicitly make rules. And by the way, our government does too. There are apps that I'm not allowed to have on my phone when I have a security clearance, right? Seems like this government has a very different opinion about what APSAs are and how they should work, but that's the story. But Russia has been working very hard, even beyond China, to control the story, to make it illegal to criticize the government, to block all the ways around it. It was very funny. I was at a conference in China once, and the only way we could use what was back then Twitter was to find one of our Chinese students, get one of their college kids to come show us how to get around the rules. And now China has tightened that up. You can't do that anymore. If you go to an international hotel, they'll let you use your internet, but it's monitored. If you go to a local Chinese, can't. Russia's moving in that direction and has been moving on some of the harder to control apps by a combination of law and things. But this smartphone app being now the, if you're going to want to be able to send a message to anyone, this is what you're going to have to use. If you want to install an app on your phone, we're going to know you did it, right? And that really is, you know, again, calling Russia under Putin an authoritarian state doesn't seem to confuse anybody. Yeah. It very clearly is. And this is yet another step by authoritarian state. What can you do? How do you do these things? Turns out not to be that hard for a state to largely, for a country to largely shut down internet. Russia's problem is it can't really do that major shutdown. Just nobody can get in or out without our permission because they are such a large company, do have so many trade negotiations, you know, banking system, things like that. So they don't want to shut down the whole thing, but putting more and more controls over what can be said. So now somebody in Russia wants to buy some product from somebody somewhere else, you know, a company, that'll go through. So that if you shut down the internet, you wouldn't be able to do that. But if some individual wants to communicate with some individual in another country, that's now going to be monitored and potentially illegal.
I think you're drawing the comparison with China is apt. And I travel to China pretty regularly. I've been going there for 30 years. And what's the so-called Great Firewall of China has been in place for a long time. And that prevents things like Google. You can't get on Google in China without, but there are workarounds. And it's not just, it is in some of the big international hotels, but you can also get a subscription to a service that basically creates kind of a tunnel around the Great Firewall. And a lot of Chinese people have access to those tunnels, and they use them. It's very tough. In addition to having access to those tunnels, everyone is using apps on their phones that are controlled in some way by the government. And WeChat is the app of that is sort of central to life in China. It's not just social media. It's not just messaging. It also includes your banking. I mean, and the government can track your location through WeChat. And their economy has become so digitized, and the government can really pinpoint the location. And they refined this during COVID when they used WeChat to track people's test results. And then, you know, they would know if you were trying to gain access to a particular store and you had to have your test results on your WeChat. And they haven't – governments are not likely to give up controls once they have them. So people are no longer required to proactively check in when they go into a store the way they were during COVID, but the government's ability to track you hasn't changed. And that's made it really tough for a lot of foreigners to travel in China. Like, I can't get in a taxi anymore because they don't take credit cards. Right. If you're not a Chinese citizen or if you don't have a Chinese bank account, you can't hook up your financial information to your WeChat account, and you can't pay for a taxi. And so,
what about cash?
Cash is almost non-existent in China anymore. So it's very confusing. But I think I know less about Russia, but just comparing in a macro perspective, like, why is China able to, I mean, they're not thriving. They have a lot of economic problems, but it is one of the largest economies in the world, and they're continuing to grow, and they are increasingly an adversary of the United States. And that enables their people. There's a lot of international travel that enables their people to have access to these tunnels and to know what's happening in the world. Russia isn't in the same economic position, and I think it's a much more closed society, and so it will be harder for people in Russia to overcome the great firewall that Putin's trying to put in place.
Right. The other thing to understand in China, we chat, by the way, I mean, when you ask about money, I mean, I stayed in a hotel. You know, the hotel had one of those little things where you could buy soda. They had a coffee machine. I had to get somebody to transfer some Chinese money into my WeChat account so I could get coffee from a coffee machine. I mean, that's the level of control you have there. But China has been making it harder and harder to get around these things as they discover these things. And then, of course, you have the legal system, which says, now that we know you sent this. But one of the differences, or potential differences, is China actually has a surprising amount of civilian support for this.
Right.
So China has something called your social
credit
number.
It's a social credit system.
So, for example, I had a colleague in China who at one point said, I'm sorry, I have to leave the meeting now. I haven't made my 10,000 steps yet today. And my app is monitored. And if I don't make 10,000 steps, my social credit goes down, which impacts what schools my kids can go to, what thing. But
this is like Black Mirror. It's very much like Black Mirror,
except with one difference, that China implemented much of this stuff in a way that benefited many people. At the same time, it controlled a smaller number of people. And so they really, you know, I mean, it's really interesting when I talk to my Chinese friends who know America versus the ones who really don't, in terms of just how much they care about this. They feel that when their government is on their side, that it's okay, right? I think in Russia, you're trying to see much more control of the message, in part because there's a lot more controversy. And I don't know what would happen. So, for example, if China went to war with Taiwan or something like that, which unfortunately a lot of people think may happen, that could really stoke a lot of these issues, because suddenly you would have people saying, well, wait a minute, you know, some of these political things now are getting out of control. Putin, of course, has put that in place a long time ago and is getting more and more strict about it.
So you're giving examples, and some of them are very extreme. Can this happen in the United States?
Yes. So, you know, a law was passed that was going to ban TikTok.
Right.
If it hadn't been for Trump overruling that law for various reasons that we can argue about, right? TikTok would have had to either sell out to a U.S. company or simply be removed from all the stores. People were buying old phones with TikTok installed during the time where it looked like the ban was going to happen, so that they could continue to use it, because it's become a major force. But again, that was done through legal channels. Mm-hmm. Can the government turn off various communication channels? Yes. Do we have controls in place to keep that from happening? Yes. What is the entity that controls that? The Federal Communications Commission. And there are three or four other agencies. What would happen if those agencies go the way of what you were talking about before, Joe, with the FBI and the CIA and DOD? You know, we're already seeing that happen. So, yes, the U.S. could take some of these controls. It's just much harder because five or six of our largest companies are the companies that do not want that to happen. and money in the U.S. talks.
Well, they tried to do, I think, with Apple, right? They wanted a backdoor to all Apple to Apple's operating system, which would basically, you know, I mean, that, you know, allow the, you know, the FBI, the CIA, anybody to get into people's computers. And, you know, there was a time when this was not a, you know, a liberal versus conservative, a Republican versus Democrat question. It was like, no, this is our privacy. And I've just watched that privacy erode among people that sense of privacy erode among people that, you know, once refused to get an easy pass because they didn't want to be tracked when they were traveling. And now it's like, and the same people say to me today, oh, come on. What are you going to do? Just turn yourself off completely? You know, go completely off the grid? Yeah. It's like, no, but I don't want to be tracked everywhere I go. I'd like to be able to pull up to a toll booth and pay cash and not have myself photographed every time. Just on principle.
Being tracked, I don't like the ticketing part of it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, by the way, can I give you my bus speeding zone tickets? I didn't know there was a bus zone on Central Avenue.
Bus zone.
I discovered that.
I've School discovered zone, all kinds of things in the mail that you get from Albany lately about various infractions that I swear I didn't mean to do.
Yeah. And you're welcome, Mayor Sheehan.
Yes.
I helped you with your budget this year.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up the show, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Good morning. Welcome back to The Roundtable and last segment of the program this morning, and we will end with what we're calling the all-or-nothing plan as Benjamin Netanyahu vows to occupy Gaza as U.S. touts all-or-nothing hostage plan. President Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, announced the end of piecemeal ceasefire negotiations. This happened as Hamas started to release more hostage videos. Netanyahu will meet with the defense officials Tuesday night to discuss his military plans, according to a person familiar with the prime minister's schedule who spoke on the condition of anonymity. Netanyahu will separately convene his security cabinet this week to direct the Israel Defense Forces how to achieve the three war objectives we have set: defeating the enemy, releasing our hostages, and ensuring that Gaza will never again threaten Israel, according to a Monday statement released by his office. The moves indicate that efforts to reach a ceasefire with Hamas in the enclave appear to have reached an end, or at least a point of extreme brinkmanship. The White House did not respond to questions on the Israeli plans yesterday or this morning and declined to expand on comments Saturday by Steve Witkoff, President Donald Trump's special envoy in the negotiations. Witkoff told hostage families in Tel Aviv that his proposal for a temporary ceasefire and the return of about half of 20 living Israeli hostages still held in Hamas in Gaza doesn't work, and we have tried everything. Trump, Witkoff says, now believes that everybody should come home at once, no piecemeal deals. He said the administration was formulating a new all-or-nothing plan. Both sides have rejected elements of the Witkoff proposal that has been on the table. And just to add that the State Department declined to comment on all of this. Malia.
Well, this is Donald Trump's first real foray into the worst kind of Middle Eastern political crises. And he's been no more successful than any of his predecessors in solving these problems. Apparently, he's not giving up. He's going to regroup and try another tactic. But I think the realities on the ground are so difficult and getting worse. It's hard to imagine they're getting worse. The only thing that I've seen that's really changed in the past week or so is that some of the surrounding Arab states came out and said they're starting to put pressure on Hamas to deal with Israel. And the Arab states have largely stood silent throughout this entire crisis. It's part of the long tragedy of the Palestinian people that, especially in Gaza, that they are attacked by Israel, but the Arabs and surrounding countries don't really come to their aid. It's been politically useful for the leaders of some of these Arab countries to let Israel treat the Palestinians the way it has, and they stand back and let the Palestinians take it. There's a 7-mile-long border between Gaza and Egypt, and Egypt could be doing more to help people in Gaza or to open that border, and they've decided not to do that. But some of the surrounding Arab states have recently, I think it was last week, said for, and I think this is the first time they've come out and said this, that they think that Hamas needs to deal with Israel and needs to stand down in Gaza. But it's too late for the tens of thousands of people who are suffering horrific fates in Gaza. It's terrible all around.
Jay.
When we wrote about this weekend, we referred to Trump's handling of this as feckless dithering, and I think it was a fair if harsh characterization of it. Every day this president, or every few days this president, seems to have a new idea of what to do there. There is no consistency. I mean, if last I heard, Witkoff was going to the Middle East to see the starvation in Gaza firsthand, and what did he come back with? We're done. We're done piecemeal negotiating. That has nothing to do with the starvation going on in Gaza. This is an administration that they just cannot handle serious foreign policy, and I think that unfortunately this game that Trump, this real estate game that Trump and Netanyahu are playing with basically, I do think they want the ethnic cleansing of Gaza and the forced displacement of 2.2 million people, or what's left of them, is the long range plan here, and it's a slow motion. Ethnic cleansing is the best word I can come up with for it. I mean, you know, other people use genocide, other people use war crimes, whatever it is what is going on there. And I think Netanyahu, you know, says one thing from one day to the next, but I think consistently he has been, this has been the end game, I think, consistently from the beginning.
Yeah. You know, as president of a synagogue and a Zionist, I got to tell you, I wish I could disagree with anything you just said, but you're absolutely right. And I think we've reached the point where, in fact, if you look at the American Jewish community, what was once, you know, if you, in early October, November of 2 years ago, when you had the Hamas attack, it was pretty clear. Now, most of us are there. There's a large split in the community, but you won't find a lot of people who back this notion that starving the kids in Gaza is a good idea. However, you still have political leadership in Israel who are doing that. You had a turn to the right wing there for a lot of reasons, good and bad. And I think the answer is now we have these two sides that are not each want to get rid of the other. Mm-hmm. And you have a horrible situation that's not going to end, because eventually, let's say you do relocate so many Gazans, you do end up with a situation where Israel reoccupies it, mm-hmm. right? Israel occupied Gaza for a long time. realized it was not in their best interest, moved out of Gaza, and that led to repercussions that were very unexpected. They thought this would be taken as a positive by the Gazans, and in fact, that's what allowed the Hamas takeover. So it's a very, you know, the situation there is a mess. It's gotten messier. But the current treatment of the civilians in Gaza is just ridiculous. And as you say, it really is ethnic cleansing.
And I think Netanyahu is under the pressure of the possibility of parliamentary election, early elections next year. That gives him a few months. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. I know. We could go on and on. And doesn't it seem like we have?
Yeah.
But that's okay. But we'll continue and talk more about this. J. Jim Malia, thank you very much.
Thank you. Back.